You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Every year, about 150,000 cases of valley fever are reported. It's an infection caused by the toxic soil-dwelling fungus Coccidioides immitis, which exists in the southwestern United States. In an article called Death Dust, the Valley Fever Menace, New Yorker staff writer Dana Goodyear wrote about the fungus and the illness and looked into why there's been an increase in infections in recent years. It appears in the January 20th issue of the New Yorker, and I'm very pleased that Dana Goodyear, whose latest book is Anything That Moves, could join us now. Hello, welcome back to our show.
Hi, thank you so much.
You begin your article with a description of a dust storm in the San Joaquin Valley in California in 1977. Can you describe what happened?
Yeah, it was just before Christmas, and it was during a time not unlike our own time of extreme drought in California. But the weather in Bakersfield, which is sort of at the base of the San Joaquin Valley, was normal until just a couple days before Christmas. A big weather system came in from the Midwest and collided with another weather system that was coming down from the Pacific and created an enormous burst of wind, which came over the Tehachapi Mountains and slammed into the ground sort of right near Bakersfield, kicking up an enormous dust plume. So this plume took the soil from Bakersfield and flung it up into the sky, distributing it over an area the size of Maine and blotting out the sun for four counties. So what was significant about this was that researchers had long known that there was a toxic fungus in the soil around and endemic to the San Joaquin Valley, which caused a disease called valley fever, also known by its nickname Coxie, because the fungus is Coccidioides immitis, as you mentioned. This spore had never been seen as far north as Sacramento, but in the days and weeks following the dust storm, there were hundreds of cases reported in Sacramento, and ultimately six people died from it. So researchers were able to study the onset and effects in an unimmunized population of this toxic soil spore.
So people had developed some immunity in the Bakersfield area?
Yeah, let me say that Coxie can be very, very serious in a small number of cases, but most people who get exposed don't even realize that they're exposed. And those subclinical infections, 60% of the people who are exposed have a subclinical infection, they are presumed to be immune for life after that. That's basically where science is right now. There's a lot that's not well understood about the disease, but that's an assumption that has been going for a long time and has yet to be disproved. So then about 40%, so let's say 37% of people will have symptoms that are like a very bad flu, and very, you know, feverish, weak, coughing. Sometimes it takes months and months for people to be back on their feet and back at work, so there's a lot of lost time there. Kids are out of school for months on end when they have fall in that 37% of people with symptoms. And then a much smaller subset will have a very severe reaction, and their immune system just won't be able to keep the fungus in check once it enters the tissue, and some of those people die. When it spreads to your brain, basically, those people die.
And there are no drugs?
There are drugs. The drugs that exist are fungistatic, meaning they can keep the fungus in check, but they are not fungicidal, so they cannot kill the fungus.
What does the fungus do inside the body when its spores are inhaled?
So the first thing that happens is that one of these tiny spores will lodge down in the base of the lungs. And from there, it immediately changes its life cycle is different in a mammalian host from what it is in the soil. So in a mammalian host, it will form a little sphere. It will sort of circle up into a little sphere. Inside that sphere, it will grow about 100 endospores, so baby spores inside the spherule. And at a certain point, that spherule will rupture, and the endospores will travel through the lymph system and through the blood to other parts of the body, soft tissues, organs, bones, skin, occasionally the brain in the worst case scenario. And the body, what happens is that the body's immune response to the rupturing of that spherule is to send a lot of white blood cells, and then there's a lot of inflammation. There's not actually a toxin in the sphere or in the endospore, but the body's reaction to it is so extreme that sometimes blood flow can be disrupted and ultimately necrosis sets in. So it kills you, it kills the tissue just by being there. Most people's immune system can control it and reach a kind of a balance with the fungus, which never goes away. But people with compromised immune systems, people with certain forms of diabetes, people with HIV, people who are on immunosuppressive drugs, and then for unknown reasons, people who meet certain racial and ethnic descriptions sometimes have a much harder time controlling it.
African Americans and Filipinos, for example.
In particular, and Hispanics, too. Yeah, and people...
I assume there's a genetic reason for that.
That's what is assumed, but again, that research has not been done. So one of the things that is true about Valley fever is for a disease that has such potentially devastating consequences to some people and affects quite a lot of people, there's been very little funding for research. So there are, and it's also a very complicated question. What's the genetic basis for that pattern that's been recognized for a long time, which is that people with darker skin tend to have worse outcomes. But, you know, it's also true, as one research said to me, that if you are warm-blooded and you can breathe, then you can get this. So it's not limited. I certainly met a number of people who did not meet any of the sort of high-risk factors who had very bad cases of it. So,
And must it be inhaled, or can you get it just by contact, surface contact?
In a few cases of surface contact are known, but generally it's by inhaling the spore. So if you have an open wound and you come into contact with a surface that has a spore on it, it can enter you that way. But really, there are a few cases in the literature of that. It's really something that is inhaled.
My guess is Dana Goodyear, her article in the New Yorker, January 20th issue, is Death Dust, the Valley Fever Menace. You mentioned that little research has been done on this. We're talking about 150,000 cases every year. We heard an awful lot about West Nile virus when we had outbreaks of that. Is there any reason why this is not getting that kind of attention?
Well, I should say there is a lot of research, and there have been, you know, people have devoted their lives to the study of this, but the funding has not been there. So the large scale, you know, clinical trials and things like that take a lot of money and a lot of effort, and usually a collaboration between private companies, pharmaceutical companies, and the government. That has not really been done with Valley fever to a great extent. But a lot of people in the Valley fever community, if I can say that, feel that its regional status has affected its funding and the progress of you know, the development of drugs and finding a cure for it. So it's something that is in some ways it's limited to the desert Southwest, and I'm only talking about in the United States. It's also present, however, in semi-arid regions of Mexico and South America. But in our country, it's the desert Southwest.
But that's Arizona and Southern California. That's a large area.
Large areas with large populations and very attractive to tourism, I might add. So it's not as if nobody ever goes to these places. And increasingly, as development pushes, you know, communities deeper into the desert, it's becoming more of a problem. So, but the feeling among people in this Valley fever community is that because it's the desert Southwest and it's not Washington, D.C. or New York City, the public awareness is a lot lower and the sense of urgency is lesser.
You write about a 26-year-old woman with Valley fever. What happened to her and how is she being treated?
Well, she had a very severe case. She was 26 years old. and white and didn't have pre-existing health conditions. So she fits into the if you're warm-blooded and you can breathe, you can get this category. But she was actually a student at a school in the Antelope Valley, which is an area that I talk a lot about in the piece where this is becoming more and more of a problem. And she was in an aerospace program there where she was actually learning how to build airplanes. And all the students would take their lunch break outside, and she suspects there was a large construction site nearby, and the wind is very high there. And she just suspects that that's where she's got it. It's very difficult to prove when it's environmental where you acquired the disease. And certainly in her case, her school, and in other people's cases, the companies try to make an argument that you can't prove that it came from, that they're responsible for it. But she had a case where it disseminated to her brain, and she's being treated in a way that, it sounds just impossible to imagine. She's had 22 spinal taps. She was considering having her 23rd spinal tap. She has a 4-inch needle put in at the base of her brain, basically right at the top of her neck, and it's called amphotericin B, the medicine that is injected through that needle, and her doctor and others call it amphoterrible because it's got such unpleasant side effects. But when it goes to the brain, when the COSI goes to the brain, it's really one of the few ways to treat it. And so then, it's 2 hours of this medicine dripping into the brain, and then she would have to lie with her feet higher than her head to prevent headaches for several hours. But the medicine made her sorry, I don't know if this is a little graphic for your show, but the medicine
and it is lunchtime, I should point out,
yeah.
Dana.
Okay. Well, the medicine was very uncomfortable for her in ways that were made more uncomfortable by having her head below her feet. So she really suffered, and she had a shunt in her brain, permanent shunt in her brain to administer the medicine, and she had another shunt to because her veins were all shot from the amount of medicine she had to take intravenously. So her life was, I think it's fair to say, her life was totally ruined by this.
Yes, it sounds like it.
She went outside to breathe, take her lunch break outside one day on the wrong day, and the wind kicked up, and she breathed this thing in.
Is this related to meningitis? Because what you're describing sounds like meningitis.
Well, that is the form that she had, and the most dangerous form is coxemeningitis. So when it gets into your brain and it causes swelling in your brain. So again, the spore itself it doesn't release the toxin. It's just its presence and its growth creates inflammation, which then, diverts blood flow and leads to necrosis. So it is coxemeningitis when it's in your brain.
My guest is Dana Goodyear, staff writer for The New Yorker. Her article, Death Dust, the Valley Fever Menace, appeared in the January 20th issue of The New Yorker, and we'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Dana Goodyear of The New Yorker. Her article, Death Dust, the Valley Fever Menace, appeared in the January 20th issue of that magazine. And we've been talking about the Southwest, originally Bakersfield and then Southern California, but also Arizona, where most of the illnesses seem to be popping up. Also Michigan. How did somebody come down with it in Michigan, a man named Ken Williamson?
Yeah, well, this is what's really scary, is the idea that you might not even have to visit these places in order to be exposed. So this fellow, Ken Williamson, lives in Grand Rapids, and his in-laws, like many people in the Midwest, spend their winters in Arizona. So let me just pause on that and say that alone is sort of is a very scary thing, that a lot of people from outside the endemic region who are older, who may have some health complications, travel to these places and spend significant amounts of time there. So they don't have acquired immunity and they may have some immune compromise. And so that's a very vulnerable population. The I can never
remember. Aren't children and the elderly often the most vulnerable in situations like this?
Exactly. And here you have a place that is particularly attractive because of its supposedly healthful climate, you know, the desert and the sun to older people. Sometimes people call them sunbirds, and sometimes people call them snowbirds, and I never know what the right one is. But you know who I'm talking about. It's you know people who go and spend the winter months in desert areas. And so, but Ken Williamson is a 44-year-old guy living in Grand Rapids, but his in-laws spend their winters in Arizona, and they knew he was looking for a car, and they had some neighbors who had a car that. They thought that was a good deal, and so they thought Ken would want it. They drove it back to Michigan for him. He had a little work done on the ventilation system in the car. It wasn't working properly, and a couple weeks after he got the car, and he even installed car seats for his small children in the back, he got this sore on his lip, and he thought, he didn't know what it was, but he went got nervous. He Googled it, and it was growing and growing and growing. Initially, he thought it was some kind of a little pimple or something like that, and then he thought, oh my gosh, is this somehow a cold sore? And then he thought, I don't know what this is, and the doctors were treating him for all kinds of different things, giving him antibiotics, giving him various things, and this lump kept growing, and it became a patch about the size of a nickel, and what it turned out to be was cocci that had disseminated to his skin, and his infectious disease specialist said, it seems the only possible source of the infection was the car itself. So, the idea that this spore can travel, and it's certainly not that's not the first instance of this. It's just an interesting story that I happened to come across in the course of my reporting. But for decades, there have been stories in the scientific literature about, it's called fomite infection. So when you're infected not from being in the endemic area but from exposure to a spore, there's a guy recently in Hong Kong who is his job was to sweep out the storage rooms where the shipping containers are delivered, and he got it off the bottom of a shipping container that had presumably come from, Port of Long Beach or somewhere in our area out here. And that case was written up, and people who work with, agricultural products that have come out of the endemic area that have been exposed and sickened. So it's something, the risk to the rest of the country is not you might buy a car from Arizona, really.
I have to tell you, Dan, I'm never getting into a car with Arizona license plates again.
I know. I see them all the time. I think a lot of rental cars come out of there. The real risk is that as our climate changes and more areas of this country become hospitable to the spore and to the growth of this fungus, and as more and more people in this country are immune compromised, and that is a growing population, that there will be an even greater number of infections that affects people across a broader swath of the country.
Well, how aware are people who live in California's Central Valley and in Arizona and other parts of the Southwest of this problem?
It depends. It's very the knowledge of it is very localized. In Bakersfield, which is a center of the study of this disease, people are acutely aware of it.
Well, I used to live in Fresno. Was I in danger?
Yes. You probably had it and didn't know it. How long did you live there?
Oh, only a summer with relatives outside of Fresno.
What were you doing there?
Spending a summer with relatives.
I was young.
Were
you working on a farm or anything?
No, but there was a lot of brown grass all around.
Well, you may have been exposed and not even had symptoms. It's tricky now because there used to be a skin test on the market so that there was a very easy way, didn't require drawing blood, easy way of telling whether someone had been exposed or not. But that skin test is not on the market anymore, and the manufacturer can't afford to put it out because the manufacturer will lose money on it if they have to pay the $600,000 annual fee to the FDA. So there are some politicians who are working to get the FDA to waive that fee, but it's a kind of a frustrating thing because Valley fever is such an expensive disease, both in terms of human health and you know, the, what it costs to treat people with it. And, you know, this relatively small sum is could do a lot to help people with the diagnostics. But in any case, people in Bakersfield, for example, are keenly aware of it. People in Tucson and in Phoenix there's a fair amount of awareness, but, you know, doctors, one of the problems is doctors are trained elsewhere and go to these cities, and they don't necessarily know about it. So it's something that is really entering the conversation now, is how can we make more people aware of it. But I also think there's something happens that where if you can't avoid it because you live in a place where it's endemic and the wind blows and what can you do, I think that there's a psychological desire to repress the information because you can't, you know, if you live your life afraid to breathe, you can't live in that place. So what can you do?
Well, are the people building housing developments trying to keep potential buyers from finding out more about Valley Fever?
You know, it's hard to point a finger at some, you know, some grand conspiracy, but it's very inconvenient, this reality. I will say that. And people are not eager to advertise. They are eager to advertise many things about the region, but not the possibility of infection from this fungal spore, you know, and exposure to a disease for which there is no cure and no vaccine currently. But there are places, one of the places we talked about a little bit earlier is the Antelope Valley, and what interested me about that place is that, first of all, it's part of L.A. County, and for about 25 years, it has been, 25 years ago, it was this sleepy little agricultural community, and then these big, there's been a housing boom there, there's cheap housing, that's good housing. It's very attractive to a lot of people from the city of L.A., and it's also become incredibly attractive to alternative energy companies. And there are a couple of solar projects already underway there, but there are 30 lined up. And, you know, this is part of California's push for energy, renewable resources to provide 20% of the energy for California by 2020. And this is a place of abundant land, abundant sunshine, and the Valley Fever Spore. Part of the problem here is that you have a population coming out of, who probably have not been exposed before, so no acquired immunity. People coming from the city of L.A., a lot of them are African American, and they are particularly vulnerable to the worst forms of the disease, and they're going to a place where there's a lot of construction going on, housing construction, and a lot of solar construction, and there's a lot of soil disturbance, and there's a lot of wind out there. So you have these sort of a convergence of these factors that you just think that there's a public health crisis looming here, and in fact, there has been a 545% increase in the number of Valley Fever cases in the Antelope Valley.
It's also had a real impact on prison population.
Yeah, and you know, again, starting in the 80s, California started building prisons in the desert, and a lot of them, and in the endemic area, in what people call the hyper-endemic area, which is, you know, to say even more cases there, and prisoners are moved in, people who haven't necessarily been exposed to it before, and they are sitting ducks. They are having, you know, they exercise outside, they work outside, they may be particularly vulnerable because they have immune-compromising conditions, or they may meet the racial and ethnic criteria that make them more vulnerable. And so, in fact, a federal judge last summer ruled that about 2,600 of the most vulnerable prisoners had to be removed from two prisons in the Central Valley. This is not a long-term solution. It may help some of those people because the rates in those prisons have just been astronomical, and there have been a number of deaths related to Valley Fever in those prisons. The judge said that this is cruel and unusual punishment, and ruled that those prisoners had to be removed, but they can't close these prisons, and people are being moved in who might not fit those exclusion criteria, but there's no reason to think they might not get sick.
And Dana, the worst drought in recorded history has affected Southern California and much of the Southwest. I'm assuming that's made this situation even worse.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly you know, one of the ways, it's very, feels very sort of rudimentary, but one of the ways to control the spread of valley fever is just to wet the dirt, wet the ground. There are other problems associated with that, which I can talk about a little bit, but the fact is that we're not, that the dust is flying around here because we are in the middle of this drought. So I think the conditions we're living with these conditions that are going to just, that suggests that we would just see a steady rise and steady increase in cases. And, in fact, that's what CDC is seeing and predicting more of.
You traveled around with a scientist named Andrea Lauer. What is she trying to do? And is she worried that she's going to be exposed and her children are going to be exposed?
Dr. Lauer is really brilliant, interesting scientist. She's an environmental microbiologist. She's German, so she is, came to Bakersfield. She works out at Bakersfield, and she got there 6 years ago. You know, you could say by now she may have been exposed, but she has two children who, you know, when she first got to town, she let them, they joined the soccer teams and, you know, all the kinds of things that kids do. And since she started studying the soil and looking for cocci in the soil, because that's her specialty, she has pulled them out of their sports activities. She just doesn't want her children outside when they could be exposed. And she deals with, you know, being a person who lives and does her work in Bakersfield. She also is somebody who goes intentionally to places where she's likely to find it and take soil samples. So she's definitely at risk, but she's wanting to establish something that has not yet been established, which are, you know, what are the parameters for growth for Coccidioides and Mitis in the soil. So what she's hoping to find ultimately are bacteria or some antagonists to it in the soil. So maybe she can create a solution of those antagonists and spray it and kill off the cocci in the soil. You know, the idea of doing large-scale fungicidal sprays is not appealing on a lot of levels, and it's environmentally probably really dangerous. But if you could do these sort of hyper-targeted sprays before, say, you know, putting a high-speed rail system through the middle of the desert, which is a big project that is, it's sort of stop and go here in California. But there are massive construction projects planned right through the endemic area. And as far as anybody knows, no consideration of precautions that they might need to take because of the cocci in the soil there.
Dana Goodyear is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her recently published book had nothing to do with what we've been talking about. It's called Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture. In this case, it's about an article about when you wind up eating dust inadvertently, death dust, the valley fever menace. It was in the January 20th issue of The New Yorker. Dana, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure talking to you.